Coming up on this week's show, Vectrex owners' prayers are answered.
Your chance to own one of the 90s most obscure consoles.
And we celebrate the C64 community with Jeff Scott.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our wonderful mates at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen Neo Geo, A Visual History? Now, of course, the Neo Geo, the system that manages to captivate gamers who are maybe in awe of its power or its price tag back in the day. And if, like me, you're one of those people who always dreamed about owning one but never got the chance, Neo Geo, A Visual History is the next best thing. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 394. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And welcome to the podcast that every Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the golden age of video games, reminiscing about the classic systems, the classic games, bringing you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week, and of course bringing you a fascinating interview on the podcast every single Friday. Basically, if you know this sound, then this is the podcast for you.
Oh, what is that?
Come on, Joe.
Is that the Famicom? No. Famicom Disk System. No, it's not. No, it's not.
What is that? Call yourself a Sega fan.
Oh, it's the Mega CD.
Of course it is. The startup sound to the Mega CD. I thought then you were going to slip up. So I thought you were going to say it's the Sega CD.
Nah.
Which is obviously what the American... See, the American one's got a different sound. The American one's this.
You were ready for
the Sega
me.
Sega CD. Yeah, there you go. I should be saving these for the Christmas quiz, really, which is now only 3 months away, but there you go. So that's what we do on this podcast. We geek out about all things retro, and of course, it's been a very busy week for news, so we'll bring you up to speed on all that in just a minute. And I'm getting ready for an amazing event next week that I'm really excited about, because, I mean, summers for us are generally quite busy. It's turned out over the last couple of years that through kind of no fault of our own, we've generally gone to events probably individually rather than all together. Ravi was over in Norway last month at Retro Mesa. I'm actually off to a great little Amiga event that's in a place called Spoleto in Italy next weekend. Now, this is happening on a Sunday, actually. Sunday the 17th of September. It's a day called Amiga Passion. And this is completely different to any of the show I've been to. Basically, it's a really small, intimate group. It's a completely free event as well, where you come along, you enjoy some systems. It's kind of in the vineyard area of Italy. So, you know, there's nice wine, there's nice food flowing, and, you know, it's going to be a really nice, intimate event by the looks of it. And it's all outdoor as well. So it basically looks like something, you know, completely different to any other retro event that I've been to before.
It looks quite interesting. So I used to, you know, be into the demo scene and check out stuff. Mm. And there was always a Spoletium, which was like the Italian demo party. And obviously, 150 people would attend there. And that was in exactly the same region. So it's probably got a lot of the same people that were there. And that was around 2000 and 1999. And they always had some good demo releases coming out from there.
Yeah, because I mean, it's an area of Italy that I haven't been to before, but I mean, I've been checking some videos out. It looks beautiful. So I'm a big fan of Italy, you know, many go for the pizza and wine, if I'm honest. But yeah, I mean, it looks really good. And I think it's generally the people that have been there go back every year. Like Alistair Brimble's coming out there. He messaged me, said, I think it's like his third time he's been there now. Mev Dink's coming out as well. So it really seems like a bit of a kind of hidden treasure.
Yeah, and, so, and that's the Passione Amiga guys who run the magazine then, I guess.
Yes, yeah, I think it is, yeah, that would make sense. So yeah, it was Paolo from, who runs the event, he basically got in touch with me, asked if I want to come out and attend it. I'm doing a little talk on the Sunday as well. So yeah, it's just something different that, you know, a nice little way to end off the summer, I think. So if you're anywhere in that region or you can get out there, I believe it is completely free entry as well. So I'll link that up in our show notes. If you want to come along, I would, I'd get there early though, because it only looks like a small little place. But yeah, so looking forward to that. And of course, today we're going to be celebrating another Commodore system, the Commodore 64. Now, this is really interesting because we've talked about the C64 before. We've had guests on who've made movies about retro systems. Generally, when you find a movie like, you know, Bedrooms to Billions, you know, those kind of things, they celebrate the historical aspect of the systems more than anything else, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And they kind of look at the games and do a bit of nostalgia and reminiscing. And they're really good because, you know, they're interviewing people from back in the day. But the C64 was incredibly popular as well. The best-selling single computer model of all time.
And this is a new film that has literally just gone up for crowdfunding this week. And you can watch a 10-minute preview for free on YouTube that, of course, I'll link up as well. It's a movie called I Adore My 64. Now, the difference about this is, rather than looking at, you know, how the Commodore 64 was made and the programmers that made the games back in the 80s, this is actually a celebration of the Commodore 64 community and what's happening now. So he's done a bit of travelling around North America mainly, and so far he's spoken to a few people that I'm sure you're familiar with if you're into the 64, Bo Zimmerman, David Murray, the 8-bit guy, Anthony Becker, you know, from Guru Meditation, Leif Bloomquist is in it as well. So this is really, it's looking at Commodore user groups, it's looking at new hardware, people that are making new software, and celebrating what the Commodore 64 community is in 2023. And Jeff, who is the guy behind this movie, he's been a lifelong fan of the Commodore 64, but also he's been a movie maker for 25 years. So that is one big difference between, you know, a lot of the kind of history videos you might have seen before and, you know, YouTube videos, for example, that the production quality of this is super high. If you watch it, it looks like it could be a TV program.
It did look really good. Like when they were interviewing people, they were going into the towns and stuff, and there was like this drone footage. And yeah, it looks really impressive from that preview that I've seen.
Yes, I mean, obviously the Commodore 64, like you said, such a big seller back in the day. And it's really a movie that honors its legacy and focuses on the community that's keeping it alive today. So that is up for crowdfunding right now on Seed and Spark. I'll link that up in our show notes. It's got around 26 days left. So if you want to get this movie over the line, obviously you're going to hear all about it with Jeff Skop. He's going to be our special guest in around half an hour from now. Obviously, we do a lot of reminiscing and, you know, talking about his memories of the Commodore 64 and a really, you know, interesting look at what the C64 community is today. So hang around for that. And if you want to back that on the crowdfunder, I'll link that up in our show notes as well. So let's get straight into this week's news stories. It has been another busy 7 days in the world of retro. And Ravi, you've been talking about getting a Vectrex for years. And I've got to say, I think you've probably kind of missed the boat now to get a cheap Vectrex.
I've given up.
The C-Systems are not getting, they're not getting any cheaper, are they?
Well, if I get one, you know, it's probably going to break and then I'll have to get another one to repair it. And, you know, I'm kind of moving into the world of emulation now because maintaining a lot of these old machines, it's like kind of having an old car collection. And yeah, it's kind of like, I kind of like the idea of new hardware and stuff.
Well, at the moment, there is a bit of a shortage for Vectrex controllers, because apparently that is one thing that can break. You know, these controllers, they attach to the front of the machine, don't they?
Yeah.
And if you want a good condition one, if yours isn't working anymore, they can sell for, you know, up into the high hundreds, you know, to get one in decent condition. But it turns out that someone has seen a bit of a space in the market for new Vectrex reproduction controllers.
Yeah, so this is interesting. Like you just said to Ravi, I think, I don't know how much a Vectrex sets you back now, but I know it was at least £400 a couple of years ago, and the controllers are, you know, half, if not more, of that cost. And yeah, a lot of them are failing, unfortunately. You know, they're like 40 years old now, the Vectrex. And it's weird because they're actually bolted to the system, aren't they, with the Vectrex? Because obviously, for those who don't know, the Vectrex is essentially, it's a CRT TV, isn't it? With the game console, it's all one unit, and then the controllers are bolted into the front, and it's kind of like a cassette kind of like drawer, which they like sit in, don't they? But yeah, this is really interesting. So you can buy a reproduction, you know, modern controller off a German website called Norths.de for €95.
Right.
So quite a bit cheaper than what they seem to be going for. And they're boasting that they're, you know, they're higher quality. So, you know, they've still got the full analog control stick there, and they boast, you know, arcade style buttons. So the buttons do look a little bit different. The original Vectrex has got like the more kind of smooth concaved buttons, whereas these are a little bit more kind of like arcade rounder, you know, kind of like Smarties kind of buttons. The only way I can describe
what you'd find
them
on a standard arcade
what you'd
machine,
find on a standard arcade machine. So a little bit different, but yeah, €95, still not massively cheap, but if you've got a perfectly good working Vectrex, but it's got a dodgy controller, or you want a second player controller, because, you know, there is two controller ports on them to bolt in there, this could be a, you know, a cheaper, not cheap, but cheaper alternative. And it, as Ravi just said, hopefully this one won't break so soon, you know, if you're buying a brand new crafted one.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I'm looking on eBay at the moment, and I can't find any Vectrex controllers on their own.
Oh, wow.
Probably because, like you said, I mean, they're kind of attached to the front of the system. But there are some Vectrex on here, and one sold 2 weeks ago in Blackpool for £200.
Oh, wow.
Which isn't bad, actually. But then you go a bit further down the list, there's another one here that sold for £1,400. So there does seem to be quite a variation. I imagine, though, the thing is that the probably... There's one here. I'm in a Vectrex arcade game console controller with games overlays fully working. Went for £365 at the start of September. Pretty much all of these are collection only, though, which I imagine for a system that is essentially like it's an all-in-one in a monitor.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of limits you. You don't want to ship these across the country or across the world.
Well, you talk about overlays there as well. And I'm just noticing on this site, artshop.de, well, arcadeartshop.de, they seem to be doing overlays as well for the original controllers.
Oh, okay, cool.
So, you know, you can stick them on the top of the controllers. And these new ones look like they have maybe different sizes and dimensions. So maybe they'll produce their own set of overlays for certain games with these ones as well. Because I can imagine they're not like cross-compatible.
Yeah,
I think it's cool as well that they're making reproductions of something that it is quite niche, but I think there's probably a need for other controllers like this. Because I got the, you know, the reproductions of the Atari Jaguar Pro controllers that came out probably about 4 or 5 years ago now. I bought a couple of those because the originals of those, I mean, if people haven't seen them, they're basically the six button version of the Atari Jaguar controller with their shoulder buttons that Atari made, I think, around 95. Didn't make very many of them, and they've always been kind of, you know, collector's items for Jaguar fans. The originals go for a lot of money, but someone actually did a modern reproduction of them that looks identical apart from having the Atari logo on there a couple of years ago and sold them at, you know, an affordable price. So I managed to get a couple of those in my collection. And there's stuff like I got an Acorn Archimedes computer a few years back, and it didn't come with the mouse. But it turns out the mouse actually goes for about £100 on its own.
Oh, wow.
On eBay, because it's like a custom connector. You can get adapters to use, you know, standard PC ones. But I think there is stuff like that. And someone mentions in the comments here on this article on Time Extension, they'd like a reproduction of the Philips CDI controller. Because again, they're controllers that are quite hard to find now. And if you do manage to get a CDI without, you know, one of the kind of game controllers, finding one of those on eBay is going to set you back quite a bit. So I think that's often something that people don't realize. You'll buy a system, and if it hasn't got all the parts, sometimes they can set you back almost as much as the system itself.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting looking at the Vectrex listings right now. They are just all over the place. But if you read the descriptions and stuff, it depends what they come with. And it's like some are, like you say, they're selling for £1,000, and it's because they've got the inlays and stuff, like Ravi was just saying, and it's crazy how much more expensive. I know they're not necessarily parts, but these things that are meant to come with it originally, how much more expensive it can make it. Because like you say, you can go on there and buy it now for like £300, but that is literally the unit with a controller, you know.
And if you're willing to drive across the country.
Yeah. But if you want it with all, you know, a couple of games and all the inlays and, you know, all the manuals and stuff like that, which came with it, or even the box, straight away you're tripling that. It's crazy.
Yeah, I wouldn't be trusting a Yodel to deliver a Vectrex to my front door.
Booting it over the back door for you.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have got a Vectrex, I mean, the thing is about this, even if your controllers aren't broken, I think these kind of things don't come along every day, so it's probably worth stocking up if you want to keep your systems going a long time. So looks like they're going to be available any day now, so I'll link that up in our show notes as well. Now, have you got your blankie nearby, Joe?
I have. I've got my blankie and my bop.
Yeah, going to make you feel all cosy. Feel in front of the fire. You're a fan of Rugrats back in the day?
I was.
Wasn't at all. And anything with talking babies can go away. I hated Look Who's Talking as well. God, what is it with like talking babies and people's fascination?
wasn't there a Look Who's Talking movie where it was a dog? Or did I make that up?
Oh, God, I don't know. I don't know
about that.
Was that a sequel?
Yeah, Look Who's Talking 8 or something straight to video from it.
Probably.
Yeah. But Rugrats, I mean, obviously it was a tea time institution, you know, when you came back from school back in the day. Ran from 91 to 96. Obviously still gets repeated to this day, I think. But there was actually a few video games back in the day, and there is a new one that's coming out that is very, very retro-inspired.
Yeah, this is interesting. Like you say, Rugrats ended in 96. There was a couple of films after that, and there was a a spin-off series where they were teenagers, I think around 2000, 2001.
Yeah,
I forgot,
that was weird. That
yeah,
one,
that was a bit weird. but like, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed Rugrats. I was a kid. You know, I was probably the demographic age group for it when it was on TV. But yeah, 30 years later, they've released, there was a couple of games for Rugrats for the PS1 and the N64, but this is coming out early next year. We can expect this. This is Rugrats Adventure in Gameland. And it's a brand new game. This isn't like, you know, an unreleased game like the McDonald's game, the Grimace Birthday or anything like that. This is like brand new game. And it's coming to us. Mixed Games and Wall Ride Games have developed this and produced this. And then it's going to be available through Limited Run. But what's really interesting about this is there is actually going to be two versions of it. And this looks really cool. It's a straight up platformer, very in the vein of the DuckTales for the NES and Mega Man.
Yeah.
And you can play as the four original Rugrats. So what are they? Oh, don't tell me. Phil, Lil, Tommy, and Chucky.
I knew you could name those.
I knew I could. you can play as them four, and it's like, you know, character select, and they all have different abilities, and there's six stages to kind of play through with them.
It's interesting how they've done this one. So on the modern release,
yes,
they've got the HD version, but yeah, also you can switch to the old school mode.
Yes.
So, yeah, you know, it's got that kind of like Sonic Generations thing where you could go back, but also that old school mode is the NES release.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly what Ravi just said. So it is going to be coming to the NES, fully playable on the NES with the 8-bit style graphics. But if you buy it for the modern systems, which it hasn't confirmed, but I imagine Xbox, PlayStation, PC, Switch, you can press, you know, I imagine it'll be the select or the options button, and it changes it to these beautiful HD hand.
They're based on the cartoon, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's like drawn exactly like how it used to look.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all hand drawn as well, it says. So it looks absolutely beautiful. So awesome that you can get it on the NES, you know, full NES release. It's all fully endorsed by Nickelodeon as well, who, you know, owned Rugrats. Rugrats, I think, was one of their original shows when Nickelodeon launched. But yeah, you get the HD version, which I think is wicked. And it's, like you say, you can switch between them instantly. It does also say that it is going to be co-op, but I don't know if that's like at one time or if it's going to be like Super Mario World where you kind of take it in turns. You know, when you die, it's the next player's go.
Maybe online co-op with the
HD
consoles. One, yeah.
But yeah, I think it looks wicked. Obviously, if you get the NES version, it's going to come in the old NES box and everything. That looks really cool. Interesting, like you say, Rugrats not been around for a while, but obviously it hits the nostalgia.
Well, I think it's good that they're addressing old school systems. Obviously, yeah. I hate the game, but it's good to see that there's releases covering all these areas.
Yeah,
and I quite like that. You know, get some new games for your library if you're a collector.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Joel will be running through the front door, throwing his school bag down early next year, sitting on his NES playing this.
Absolutely. No, I think I'll probably end up getting it on Xbox or Switch or something, because I do like the look of those HD graphics as well.
So. Yeah, we can switch between them by the sound of this. Like, just press a button and you can play the old school graphics on your Xbox, you know, really push that power of the Xbox Series
Absolutely.
X.
With the 8-bit graphics into HD mode.
It's funny, I was playing the Atari 50 collection on my PlayStation 5 the other day and I was like, hang on a minute, you know, this system is actually like the most powerful console on the market.
Your watch is probably more powerful.
It's mental. Exactly, yeah. The first thing I played on my Xbox Series X when I got it was the Contra collection. I played Contra.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. What am I doing?
Scaled up into glorious 4K.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if I get hold of that Rugrats game, I will link up that article. You can check out the trailer as well. It's really cool. Now, this is something that I don't think I've ever got any hope of having in my collection. You thought the Vectrex was hard to get hold of now. What about owning an ACAN system? Now, I must admit, I'd never even heard of this one before.
I'd never heard of this one. And it's interesting because the other day, I had like a really crazy thought of like, I'd love to have every console that was ever released within my lifetime. So I'm like, okay, so I need a Jaguar. And I was like, this is going to get pretty expensive if I decide to do that.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of crap there as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. You know, when you think about it, like, you're like, oh, there's an Apple Pippin. Like, you start thinking of all these stupid consoles that cost loads of money. I'd never heard of the ACAN till this week, which is an incredibly rare Taiwanese 16-bit console that launched in 1995, which was an absolute flop because apparently it just couldn't compete with the with the PS1 and, interestingly, the Sega Saturn, you know, in Taiwan.
It was big in that part of the world, wasn't it?
It was big in that part of the world, yeah. And it only ever had 12 games released for it in the first couple of months of it being out before it got canned. And for those who, you know, who haven't seen it before, it looks a little bit like a Super Nintendo. And it is 16-bit graphics, you know, 2D kind of graphics. Controller-wise, a little bit of a hybrid between a Mega Drive and a Super Nintendo controller. It just looks like a black Super Nintendo, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But the reason we're talking about this is there is one up on eBay, and it's the same seller, interestingly, who sold the Castlevania Symphony of the Night demo for the game.com last year, which we covered, which was like a, you know, like a developer's cartridge that you know, yeah, got found and released. So now he's got a Super Akon.
Sorry, it's interesting, the background of this company as well, Funtech Entertainment Corporation, because this Akon actually caused the collapse and failure of the subsidiary. So, yeah.
I'm looking at the games and I'm not surprised.
Oh, really? That bad? But yeah.
They must have gone all in, you know.
Yeah. It is based on the same chipset as the Sega Mega Drive and the Neo Geo, interestingly. But it's currently on bid with, I want to see how long, with 4 days and 9 hours remaining at the point of recording this. So it ends on this coming Monday, so 2 days after the show goes out, 3 days after the show goes out, Monday the 11th, currently on $990 with 18 bids.
Yeah, that's going to go probably up to $2,000 then a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it does come with the box, bit of cardboard.
It's got 12 games that were released for it. Yeah,
it doesn't come with any games though, this listing. so you can't even play it.
You can't go out and wait for the games.
I bet there's no Everdrive for that. Yeah,
get your Akon Everdrive out.
Yeah. But I'm looking, there is a great little video here that you can watch that I'll link up in our show notes as well by Low Score Boy, who basically runs through the games available on the system. I've not heard of any of these. I mean, there might be kind of regional titles like Formosa Duel, a game called Single Fighter that looks like a Street Fighter 2 ripoff.
Okay.
Sango Fighter, I think that's what it's called. Sango, yeah.
Okay, and yeah, well, it looks like it came out on the PC as well by the looks of it. And he's got a little side-by-side demo. Actually looks like it priced pretty well on the Akon. But it kind of reminds me of, you know, the Atari Jaguar. Instead of having Mortal Kombat, you had Katsumi Ninja. You know, these kind of games that were like ripoffs of, like, you know, big game. There's one called Speedy Dragon on here as well. That is a, you know, it's pretty, looks like a pretty decent kind of side-scrolling.
Yeah, you know what? I'm looking through the same video now. It doesn't look that bad. It just looks like a SNES. to be honest,
there's just no games you'd recognise on here.
Games you'd recognise, isn't it? What, three, four years later, 5 years later, really, in terms of the technology that it's boasting. Yeah.
And the pad doesn't look amazingly nice. Like the D-pad on the pad looks like it could be pretty horrible. It's one of those ones where it's all just raised spongy. I can just tell from the pictures it looks spongy.
Yeah. Yeah, I can as well.
I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, I really want that in my collection. I love anything like this. Anything that's only got like a handful of games. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm looking at it and it's $200 shipping to our area, Dan. Right. So, you know. You're on 1100 already.
Stay away from the wine on Friday night. So no drunk eBaying for me this weekend. So yeah, it looks really interesting though. If you want something very rare in your collection, I'm just waiting to go on the patrons hangout end of the month and someone's bought it.
Yeah.
Because you know our patrons, there'll be someone in there who's got, oh, I've got one of those. Of course I have. So yeah, if you want something really obscure in your collection, you can get yourself an Akon on eBay right now. So I'll put that in our show notes as well. Now, talking about patrons, of course, our patrons hangout is coming up in a couple of weeks' time. We do these end of the month, usually. Last Sunday of the month, traditionally, is the day for our patrons hangout. So that'll be coming up on September the 24th, only a couple of weeks away. And actually, speaking of stuff we do for our patrons, we also do a bonus podcast once a month, of which we've just done episode number 37, the Retro Hour After Hours podcast, where we're talking about our favourite licensed games. Now, I love doing the main podcast, but the After Hours, always such a giggle, isn't it, doing that show?
Yeah. And you know, when you suggested licensed games, I thought you only meant movie license, but luckily it's all kind of licensed titles as well, because there's some really bad movie license games out there as well.
Of which I picked a couple in my list. So if you want to check that out, if you join us as a gold member or above on Patreon, you will get access to all 37 episodes of that. So lots of listening, you know, a couple of years worth you'll unlock. You also get the normal podcast ad-free. You get extra bonus patrons content every week. We'll do an extra two or three news stories in every single episode. And really the main reason that you're joining us on Patreon is to support this podcast and make sure that we can keep going well into 2024 and beyond. And of course, we really appreciate all the support we get. We do have two new patrons who we'd like to induct into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming. That is, of course, the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And I'll let you guys induct them in.
Hall of Fame.
Who we got, Ravi?
We have Mark Hill
and Ramon,
who both joined us on Patreon over the last week. We hugely appreciate your support. And if you'd like to join the wonderful Retro Hours patrons community, all the details are on our website at theretrohour.com. Now, there was one of our patrons a couple of weeks ago on one of our Hangouts who showed us something really cool. This was Matthew, who's a regular on the Hangouts. And he had basically a mini pirate TV station playing around his house where he was streaming. I say streaming, but basically he was broadcasting over the air old episodes of Games Master and Bad Influence and watching them on his CRT TVs around his house.
Yeah, he had a little UHF transmitter, which is probably illegal. But
we weren't grassing.
Kind of broadcasting in the area, and then he could pick up stuff on you know, the old aerial. And that service has been turned off in the UK. So, it's pretty interesting to see.
Yeah, I did really enjoy watching Matthew demo that on our Hangout. And I did think, I've got a couple of CRT TVs in my house. And obviously, like you said, over-the-air analog television got shut off several years ago here. We're, digital only now. But I thought it would be cool if I could, because that was the way we watched them back then. And it's all well and good watching Games Master on, my 4K TV, but it's not how I remember watching it as a kid. So I thought it would be quite cool if there's a way that you can kind of broadcast it. I looked at plugging a Chromecast into one of my CRT TVs and watching it on YouTube, but then it's had the letterboxes on the side, the aspect ratio wasn't right. But if you want to see how to basically broadcast a retro TV channel in your house using the power of a Raspberry Pi, there is a great little demonstration video that's around 25 minutes long by a YouTuber called Irish Crack Party. Just to clarify, that is C-R-A-I-C.
Yeah.
Like the Irish Crack.
Really smart, this is. So he's done it in a way that, I don't think this is going to be publicly available. This is just a very specific project he's done for himself. And it's based on American cable TV. So it's not the kind of experience that we would have in the UK. We'd have a total different one. But, seeing the integration of teletext and stuff is pretty amazing. Now, the way that he's done this is he's got an LCD screen. God damn it, he should have had a CRT. But he's created this little unit, has an LCD in there. It also has a Raspberry Pi in there. It's got this little channel changer that he's kind of custom built as well. So, you can turn it with a dial and switch between the channels. Now, the cool thing about this is the build that he's using. So there's a one called Pseudo TV, which is available where you can make your own TV channel.
Is that for the Raspberry Pi then? This is,
it's for the Raspberry Pi, but it's also for, I think, the PC and stuff. It's it works with Plex and Kodi. So, it will find your streaming service and then it will take the videos out. But this guy, he decided, no, that's too modern, and that has stuff like buffering in there. Doesn't have adverts in there or logos, or it doesn't run in sync with the machine. So in C++, of course, he decided to write his own piece of software. And this is pretty amazing. He's got commercial breaks in there running for in America, they got a lot more commercial breaks than us. So it's running for a period of time, but it's also running. He decided when, the format has a chapter in it. So you've got a DVD film in there and then the chapter comes in and you change to the next one. That triggers the commercial break. But when the commercial break comes on, a channel logo comes in there. And then he thought, let's get it even more complex. So this is all working timed with the internal time of the machine. But he also said, let's get it a bit more complicated and let's do it so we can have multiple channels on there. We can kind of switch between them. But also, if it's the time period for kids' TV, you're going to get kids' adverts, later
on.
So
if it's 3 p.m., you're going to get, you're going to be watching adverts for toys and stuff.
Yeah, so he's created this basic unit that is constantly running this content and has commercial breaks and gives you the whole kind of cable experience and how it's delivered. He's even got like an MTV style channel on there with music videos. And you know what?
And Beavis and Butthead.
I miss that. You know, I miss sitting in a house just watching music videos back in the days with my mates. You look at MTV now and it's all trash. But yeah, that kind of music thing, I'd really love to have. I don't know if he's going to make this build available publicly, but...
He should. Yeah, definitely.
I love the idea of just having like one of the sources on your TV or something, just a constant streaming channel. Be good to see a British one, if they did like the old BBC with, you know, no adverts, but yeah, or they did Channel 4 late at night and stuff like that. And then you had it like turn off and go to teletext on.
You just want to watch Eurotrash again.
Yeah, watch Eurotrash anyway. But Adam and Joe show, all of that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I do love the idea of this. So basically he's got, you know, it's a 24-hour, you know, stream, isn't it, of classic TV. And he can switch between the channels. That's what I think is really cool. Because, I mean, obviously I've seen people build their own kind of fake TV channels at home. But the fact that he can basically switch between, you know, HBO on here and MTV, you know, these versions that he's made.
Yeah.
And it's all kind of running at the same time. So what you would have watched on MTV at 3 p.m. is what's on HBO at 3 p.m.
And I'd be interested in watching the American cable TV experience, you know, because I never really watched that apart from seeing videos on YouTube and stuff. You know, I think it would be quite nice having, you know, if they created some kind of database, it could be hard with copyrighted material and stuff, but, you know, having access to the American one and then seeing what was going on in Germany or then checking the UK version, it would be quite cool.
Because, I mean, there are some Twitch channels that I watch like this. You introduced me to a great one, the Old Timey Computer Show.
Yes, that's
and I keep that streaming in my office sometimes all day, and they just play a random selection of, like, you know, 80s and 90s computer and video games shows back to back. So it feels like a real TV channel. But often, you know, if I've got, like, my monitor on all day and I'm working in here for, like, 5-6 hours doing stuff, I don't want to constantly change YouTube videos all day. So having something like that stream, I think, is really good. So
yeah, and he's
even
also
if you just kind of stream these on Twitch, would be good.
Well, he's got an algorithm in there which also picks what's suited best for that time period and kind of like how a TV channel would be created. And I kind of like the idea of, you know, we've got so much choice of content now, just having that like limited selection of a few channels and getting stuff chosen for you is sometimes a lot easier than scrolling through these endless lists of stuff.
Yeah, so it looks very, very cool, recapturing that old school TV experience. If you want to check that video out, I will put that in our show notes as well. Now, this one looks really exciting, and as soon as I saw this, I thought, God, this game looks right up Joe's street. This is an action side-scroller called Demon Claw. Now, I mean, there are a lot of these kind of retro-style games around at the moment, but the big thing about this is, not only is it coming out of modern systems too, but they're porting this to quite a few classic systems as well.
Yeah, you're not wrong, Dan. You're not wrong. It's definitely up my street. Yeah, Demon Claw. Very similar look to kind of... I think it's called Demon's Crest, Gargoyle's Quest for the SNES, you know, kind of Mega Drive SNES, 16-bit style graphics, kind of dark, medieval-y fantasy kind of look, platformer. Mm-hmm. It's coming to us. So we've actually had these guys on the show. They're called Bitbeam Cannon. We had them on about 2 or 3 years ago. They were behind Metro Siege and Cyberjack and big fans of the Amiga. So this kind of started out as a, by the looks of things, an Amiga game. It's going to be on the Amiga.
I think they had a proof of concept demo that they were running when we interviewed them.
But now they've teamed up with Neofid Studios, and they're going to be launching this as a crowdfunder Kickstarter. I'm not too sure when. It just says that
next month.
And the aim is to, as well as getting this out on Amiga and modern consoles, you know, Xbox, Switch, PS4, 5, etc. It is also going to come, like I say, Amiga, Commodore, PC, and the Mega Drive, which, you know, this game absolutely 100% suits the Mega Drive, like the look of it, a very badass-looking Altered Beast, maybe.
It reminded me of Altered Beast quite a bit. And interestingly, there is a little trailer video that you can watch. Now, I was reading the comments, and a couple of the comments on there are saying, this looks great for the Amiga, but it would be good to see a Mega Drive version. And they're like, no, watch this space.
Yeah.
But actually, if you listen to the music on this, check this out. It sounds like a Mega Drive.
Mm.
But apparently that's the Amiga version by the looks of the comments.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think it needs to come out on a Nintendo system just so you can have Power Glove support. that would work wicked with this.
Well, I mean, you do joke, and there have been, I mean, I've been looking through the comments on this. People are very excited about it, but there's quite a lot of people going, hang on, why are you not bringing this out on the SNES? This will be perfect on the Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
And it feels like the Super Nintendo gets overlooked a hell of a lot for homebrew, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe it could be for licensing issues. I don't know, but. Yeah, I mean, we get a lot of NES stuff, you know, the Rugrats game we were just talking about.
Yeah.
But there doesn't seem to be too many Super Nintendo releases. I mean, you get the odd re-release for Super Nintendo. Like there was a Battletoads one not too long ago, and there was a Lion King and Aladdin one a couple of years ago and stuff like that. But they're re-releases of games that already exist. You don't see to seem new homebrew kind of Super Nintendo, or not homebrew, you know what I mean? New, absolutely brand new games.
New releases.
New releases, yeah. But this does 100%. If you showed me this with no context, I'd assume it was a Super Nintendo game or a very nice Mega Drive game.
And you mentioned the soundtrack there as well. It's by Alistair Brimble. So,
wicked.
You know, it's definitely going to sound good.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of these new games coming out that look incredible. But I just think, the fact the Super Nintendo always gets overlooked, I'm just not quite sure why. Is it a difficult system to program
tell us in the comments. I bet somebody knows. My vote is licensing issues. That's my vote.
Right. But either way, I mean, this looks like just top draw quality, doesn't it? So they're bringing this out in the Neo Geo as well.
Oh, wicked.
Interestingly. Yeah, so I mean, it's going to be Mega Drive, Amiga, PC, and Neo Geo as well. I mean, I'm looking at this and I think, you know, again, it's... Yeah, I've got a Neo Geo CD, which I know some people don't count as a proper Neo Geo. Would be nice if this came out on the CD system as well. But yeah, I mean, I just think it looks like a really polished arcade quality.
Yeah,
it's old school.
I like the idea of the multiple weapons on the glove that he's got. And, you know, it's obviously got power-ups and stuff. And then like that huge kind of, you know, Streets of Rage one where you press a button and then just completely devastate everyone in there. That like Golden Axe as well. It's got a lot of origins in those games, and the look of it is really nice with the scrolling.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of influences there, and like you say, even with like some of the animations are very Dragon Punch, Street Fighter, even though the origins of it probably sit with Golden Axe, Streets of Rage kind of style. It is a one kind of like, it's not a belt scrolling beat 'em up, it is just that one kind of level platformer beat 'em up, isn't it? But sometimes, I mean, I prefer belt scrollers, but sometimes I do like sit down and play one of these because you do get better platforming elements with these.
And I guess we're seeing the Amiga version, like they might have enhancements for the other ones, you know.
Or Neo Geo enhancements.
Or kind of more enemies or something like that.
I do love the fact as well, though, Ravi, that now, you know, Amiga games have been ported to other systems rather than the other way around.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Which is a cool thing to see. So, keep up the good work, Beam Cannon and the crew. If you want to check the Kickstarter, that is coming very soon, but I'll put the trailers in our show notes. So you can check those out. And, of course, everything else we talk about, you don't have to Google around or search on your socials or anything. Just open the show notes on your podcast app or head to our website at theretrohour.com and you can click straight through. Now, before we chat to this week's special guest, Jeff Skop, talking all about the Commodore 64 community in 2023 and his amazing new documentary, let's take a moment to give a big thank you to this week's sponsor. And of course, it is a very long-running sponsor of the Retro Hour podcast, our favourite VPN service, our wonderful mates at ExpressVPN. Now, of course, we've talked about ExpressVPN before. Everyone knows how it can protect your privacy and your security online. But something really good about having a VPN, kind of a nice little byproduct of having one of these, is that you can actually unlock movies and TV shows that are normally only available in other countries. So if you're paying, you know, full whack for services like Netflix, who seem to put the prices up like every 6 months, then this will completely change your world. Because there is so much more out there than we get on the British Netflix. For example, I think I read that there are 100 different Netflix libraries all around the world. So just imagine all the extra content that you're normally missing out on. But I know you, Ravi, always take advantage of the global Netflix library with ExpressVPN.
Well, not only Netflix as well. Like there's Hulu, you know, BBC iPlayer. And then I remember using it one for, it's called YouTube TV, which is a service that's not available in the UK. But for streaming football, my God, it was good. So I actually used ExpressVPN to go onto the American servers and sign up for YouTube TV. And then, you know, watch football 720p, 60 frames per second. Great quality that was. But, nice. You know, looking on Netflix in America, there's some interesting stuff, man. I've been checking out Team America World Police, which is absolutely hilarious. If you've not seen it, you need to check that one out. The story of Pixar as well, the Pixar story, which is a really nice documentary. And one that was weird, when I was in Atlanta in America, I walked up a road and they said, it's closed. And I was like, oh, I need to get to this shop. And they're like, no, it's closed. I said, why? They're filming Undercover Brother 2. So I'd never checked that out. But now I can actually go check it out on the American Express VPN service.
Yeah, so that's the thing. Have ExpressVPN on your system. You know, it works on all your devices too, doesn't it? You've got it on your phone, your consoles, your smart TV.
You can have it on your router, so you can just do your whole house, you know.
And it's so quick, isn't it? I mean, you have it on, you don't even realise that it's connected in the background. Never any buffering, never any lag. Stream in HD, no problem at all. So if you want to get access to hundreds of new shows, why don't you try ExpressVPN and use our exclusive link. You'll really help out the podcast and you'll get our little present to you, 3 months of ExpressVPN for free on top of a one-year plan. So head to expressvpn.com/retro. That is expressvpn.com/retro. I'll link that in our show notes as well. And a big thank you to ExpressVPN for their continued support of our podcast. Okay, next, we're going to be celebrating the Commodore 64 community in 2023 and finding out about this incredible new documentary, I Adore My 64, with this week's special guest, Jeff Skop. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And you know us, we love any excuse to talk about Commodore computers. You know, I've got to admit, even though I love all things retro, Commodore is really where my heart is. And today, I'm going to be talking to someone who's making an incredible new documentary celebrating the Commodore 64. But, I mean, you might have seen a lot of documentaries about the 64 covering the history of it. This one's different. This one actually focuses on what's happening with the Commodore 64 today. Now, the campaign just launched this week. It's called I Adore My 64, and it's launched on Seed and Spark, and I'll link it up in our show notes so you can click through and support that today. And obviously, we'll hear more about that and where the movie's come from with the maker of this new film. Let's welcome him on, Jeff Skop. How's it going, Jeff?
Hey, it's going great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Really appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk about this, what looks like an incredible new film. And I mean, obviously, if we're talking about the Commodore 64, it is nice to kind of get some personal background, because, you know, that's why we're all here, isn't it? You know, the nostalgia of it and, you know, the fact that we can geek out a bit about these machines as well. So I know that you've got some background with the Commodore 64. So what was kind of your early experience with that machine and how did it impact you?
Oh, well, I got a Commodore 64. I think I was 10 or 11 years old for Christmas. It's kind of an interesting story because I probably would have ended up with a VIC-20. But our family was away on vacation in Florida. We came back. There had been a huge snowstorm, and our entire house was flooded. And my parents had hidden this VIC-20, I believe, in the basement, and it got ruined. So, you know, several weeks later, through insurance money, it was replaced. But my dad decided, hey, as long as we're getting a free replacement, why don't we upgrade? So that's how I ended up with a Commodore 64 instead of a VIC-20. So I count myself pretty fortunate in that way. And yeah, right out of the gate, I just had a lot of good experiences with it. My first game cartridge, I think, was Grid Runner by the venerable Jeff Minter. And, nice. You know, started getting into basic programming a little bit and just really took to it and kept that machine like for a very long time. I think all the way almost to high school before it broke. And then I replaced it with a Commodore 64C, and I actually still have that machine today and it still works.
So in speaking personally, what are some of the most iconic games or software that you'd personally associate with your 64? Obviously, you mentioned, you know, Jeff Minter there. He was, you know, such a legend on that system. Anything else that kind of brings back the nostalgia for you?
Oh, yeah. I think the number one game of all time for me would not be the number one, one game for everybody else. But I tend to really like adventure story-driven games. So probably Below the Root, which is sort of a lesser known title. And then probably more of a well-known title would be Maniac Mansion. you know, that's kind of an eminently popular story-driven adventure type of point-and-click game. And yeah, spent many, many hours trying to figure that out, and never did get to the end of my own. And I'm just too prideful to use to use a walkthrough. I'm like, I still think, oh yeah, someday I'm going to complete it. But yeah, I've really enjoyed those types of games. And in the early days too, this is, I guess, probably somewhat unusual. I really enjoyed the Infocom Text Adventure series and played that a lot, especially with a close friend of mine. We just spent hours and hours trying to figure things out, often getting frustrated.
Yeah.
But yeah, just tons of fun with those titles.
I mean, the Commodore 64 had obviously lots of competitors on the market at the time. I mean, over in the UK, Sinclair Spectrum was a main competitor, and it sparked many playground wars at school, you know, which machine was the best. And I know over in the US, you had, you know, systems like, you know, obviously the Apple II, and, you know, the IBM PC was coming through, Atari 400 and 800. I mean, what would you say the Commodore 64's strengths were? What made it so special compared to those contemporary machines that were around at the same time?
Oh, I think in my mind, the graphics and sound really just blew anything else that I saw out of the water. It's interesting how sort of regionalized your experiences can be if you're from that period of time. And when you're talking about home computers, like, I never saw an Atari 400 or 800 in the wild as I was growing up. And that's not to say that there weren't people out there that used them and loved them. I'm sure there were. But where I'm from, which is like the Midwest, most of my friends, if they had a home computer at all, it was a Commodore 64. Or I had a few who had a Texas Instruments TI-99/4A. And a couple that had the Coco. But, you know, just sitting down and using those machines, it's like, this just isn't even close. It doesn't even compare. And I know during that era too, the Apple II was really popular. But I think in all my years growing up, I ever in person only ever saw one time. So, yeah, it was maybe on some levels, it's like my experiences with it were just more of a regionalized thing, and other people in other areas of the states, you know, had more experiences with other machines. But yeah, definitely the graphics and then the SID chip is, you know, it's just amazing. Nothing could really hold a candle to the music and sound effects that the Commodore 64 could produce. And then, of course, the price, right? The price was right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was important to my family for sure. And I think it was important to a lot of others out there when they were looking at entering the home computer market.
Well, obviously, I mean, the Commodore 64, you know, became the best-selling single model home computer of all time. So, yeah, definitely had that big impact on the market. It's interesting, though, because, I mean, my first machine was a Commodore Plus 4 that was an 8-bit that Commodore released after the 64 that didn't have anywhere near the same impact. And, you know, I got that because, you know, they were selling them off really cheap and my parents bought it at like a fire sale. And obviously we had the Commodore 128 that came out a couple of years later as well. But I mean, speaking of those 8-bit machines, I mean, why do you think those systems didn't have the same impact as the C64?
Well, I think it's probably a misread of the market. You know, I'm definitely not a historian or an authority on the matter, but I think, you know, the thing that really harmed the Plus 4 probably was its incompatibility with the 64. I do understand that there was a certain, you know, business intention behind it, and Bill Hurd, you know, he's taken a lot of, I think, unfair flack, you know, for the relative lackluster sales of the Plus 4 and the other computers in that series. But if you really stop and listen to him talk about why they made the decisions that they did, or you read his book, it really does make a lot of sense why he went the direction he and the rest of the team went the direction that they did. And you know, some of it was out of his control. It was people above him, like all of us at any of our jobs. You know, we can put our heart and soul into something, but sometimes the people above us make decisions that we don't agree with and impact the outcome of those projects. So, you know, and the 128, I think that is a great machine. There are a lot of amazing things it can do, you know, and some levels it's, you know, sort of a four machines in one, you know, it has so many different modes. But I think it didn't sell as well as the 64, probably just because it wasn't a 64 and the 64 was still selling during that time. You know, the 64, I think, sold like into the early 90s. And so it kind of, I think, cannibalized its own market, so to speak. That's my guess, but you know, I think the 128 was again sort of designed to meet the need of the business market with its 80 column mode and some of the other features that it had. But I think, you know, if you look back on the history of Commodore, they just had a hard time capturing that market after the PETS, because the 64 was seen as, you know, a video game machine on a lot of levels. And I think they struggled from a branding perspective to get people to take them seriously as a business computer, especially as the IBM PC came into the market.
Yeah, and I think every Commodore 128 that I've seen, so obviously you've got that Commodore 64 compatibility mode in there, and they've pretty much all got worn G and O keys and 6 and 4, where people have literally turned it on, typed go 64, hit return, and then just used it as basically as a Commodore 64. Just because you said, I mean, there's all that software out there, wasn't there? So it's, you know, it was just really tempting for people just to use it as a
C64. Exactly.
And obviously, I mean, as the 80s went on, I mean, you know, from your perspective and, you know, from the research you've done, how do you think the Commodore 64 kind of shaped the gaming industry in the 80s?
Well, I think that, and a lot of the interviewees in the film talk about this too, the ones we've interviewed up to this point, I don't think the Commodore 64 really gets the credit that it's due for the influence it had in the development and history of video games. There are so many people who are today involved in the industry because they started on the 64, and they either, you know, played it at home or played it at a friend's house. And a lot of, and that's when a lot of them began experimenting with machine language programming. And, you know, that, that's a special, that takes a special kind of skill and dedication. But I think that sort of developed a generation of programmers that went on to do great things, not only just in games, but in other, you know, software and hardware design as well. So, you know, the sort of the barrier to entry was high because learning machine language is difficult. But, you know, when you take the time to do that, and I shouldn't talk about it as if I know, because I'm not a machine language programmer. But when you take the time to dedicate yourself to learning it, I think you develop a really high level skill set. And afterwards, any other language, you know, is really just not as difficult. So, yeah, I think in that way, the 64 had an impact on that early game development market. And that's continued to pay dividends, you know, all to those companies all the way up to today. So, yeah, you know, video games are more popular now than they've ever been. They bring in more money now than they've ever have. And I think, you know, when people think about the history of the video game industry, they're more likely to think about Nintendo and Sega and sort of forget about the precursors that led into those consoles even being possible. And so, you know, that's part of what the film is about, is just recognizing the huge history and significance that the Commodore 64 and other Commodore machines had in the era.
Well, obviously we'll get into I Adore My 64 and a bit more about the film itself in a moment. But I mean, talking about the 64 community, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, it was basically, you know, local user groups were the main way that you get to meet other people that had computers. How has the Commodore 64 community evolved over the years? And what would you say kind of keeps that alive today? Was that kind of a bit of a rediscovery journey for you when you got back into all of this?
Oh, yeah. My road back into being involved with the Commodore 64 actually intersects with you, because it was probably 2017, as I was taking care of one of my newborn daughters and spending a lot of late nights poking around on YouTube, I caught a video that you had done about how the Commodore 64 can be connected to the internet. And I was really shocked by that. I'm like, wow, there's still people developing hardware and software. And that's what sort of reignited my interest and passion in getting involved with the modern day C64 community. And once I did, I was shocked. I was just floored by people around the world that are just very much dedicated into keeping the platform alive. And, you know, all the way from the, you know, these huge events where they, you know, demo scene events and coding events and just collecting, collector events all over the world, like Canada, North America, you know, all over Europe. I was just floored. I think when I was growing up, you know, we didn't have the internet. So like what was going on the other side of the world with Commodore was sort of unbeknownst to me. And when I sort of reengaged with everything, you know, 2017, 2018, I was just shocked to start to understand the huge influence that Commodore had on that side of the world. I had some friends who, you know, they were originally from Germany. So I knew that Commodore was popular over there, but that's probably all that I knew about it. Yeah. And so, but yeah, here in North America and around the world, there are just so many user groups, Facebook groups, Discords. Like, there is no shortage of community. If you want to become involved and you want to, you know, sort of re-experience the nostalgia and love that you had for the 64 or any retro platform, I don't know if it feels like it's just exploded in the last 10 years. And I don't know if it's just like people who grew up with that are now the right age to want to revisit things that they experienced in the past. But I would say in the last 10 years, it's just exploded. And I found the community to be extremely welcoming, extremely helpful, extremely kind. There's just been some true acts of kindness that I've received from people in the community. And I've tried to replicate that myself. And that's one great thing about it, is that, you know, if you have a broken machine or a piece of hardware that's not working, you want to understand how to get a certain game or piece of software working, there's just, you know, you can go on the internet, post something in a group, and 5 minutes later, literally 5 minutes later, someone's answering you and trying to help you to make it happen. And so, you know, that's really awesome. And, you know, that community just developed organically. And I think that's great and sort of unique.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, the love that people have for these machines. And it's interesting psychologically as well. I mean, you mentioned then about whether it's something to do with the fact that we're maybe a certain age now where we look back to our youth and our childhood and want to kind of recapture that. Maybe that's part of it. But I do agree with you, because I mean, I kind of got back into this whole retro thing probably around 2007. Mm-hmm. And since then, I kind of saw it start to build up, but I'd agree, in the last 10 years, it just seems like it's gone into overdrive. It feels like now, coming up, you know, I love the Commodore 64, I love the Amiga as well. The fact that there are, you know, four or five Commodore shows happening that I go to every single year now, and there's, you know, thousands of people at these events. Mm. It is interesting to think, you know, what is it that kind of brought us all back together? I mean, do you think it is that kind of just the nostalgic aspect of it?
I think it is in part, for sure. There's a nostalgic factor to it, but I also think it's the community and the relationships that you can have over something, you know, that two different people enjoy, you know. Like, as you get older and, you know, oftentimes get married, have family, have kids, it is harder to find ways to connect with people. And this just seems so natural. You know, like, I love this thing, you love this thing. Hey, let's talk about it. Let's help each other figure this out. And yeah, I just think that just opens the door. And that's just another really cool aspect of the community is, you know, I've met and talked to people around the world that there's no other way I ever would have known them, no other way I ever would have met them. And yet through this community, it's like, oh, we're like, you know, instantly there's a brotherhood there because we have this, you know, this computer in our common history.
Yeah, you're right. And that's really the main reason that I go to shows, because I've got all the machines at home. You know, if I attend an event and there's like, I barely even touch the machines, really. It's about the socializing, isn't it? And meeting like-minded people. And, you know, you can talk to someone else in a bar or a cafe, and you mentioned that, you know, oh, you're into Commodore computers. That's it. You can talk for hours. You know, there's like a common interest there, isn't there? So, yeah, you just have friends around the world. It's incredible. But I mean, speaking of the hardware, I mean, obviously at, you know, shows, and I imagine a lot of the communities and the people you visited for the film, you must have seen quite a lot of innovative and unique uses of the Commodore 64. Any like really cool stuff that you've seen during your research?
Let's see. I think the thing that I've probably been most impressed with up to this point. So we've interviewed about four people for the film. And, one of the things that's really, just stood out to me is Bo Zimmerman. Not only just because of the huge collection that Bo has, but also just all the work he's done and some of it that I was benefiting from and didn't even realize. He did a lot of work on the Wi-Fi modem that a lot of people use today now to connect to the internet. And he's also done a ton of work with BBS software and software for GEOS. And so, like, I just am floored that someone who, you know, never worked at the company, Berkeley Software, is out there developing stuff for GEOS and the Commodore 64 and, you know, contributing to the community in that way. And, you know, we actually interviewed another guy, Leif Bloomquist, who's part of the Toronto Pet Users Group, a huge Commodore group up in Canada. And he also was involved in creating one of the first Wi-Fi modems, which I had no idea, you know. And we sat down and interviewed him, and, you know, and he was talking about how his experiences with the Commodore 64 led him, you know, into doing projects with NASA. He was involved with the Canada arm, and now he's involved with the OSIRIS-REx project. And, you know, he credits all that to his early experiences with the 64. So maybe not so much what's really stood out to me is, you know, unique hardware projects, but the experiences that people have been led into and the career paths they've taken because of their early involvement with the 64.
Yeah, and I mean, there is so many new games coming out all the time as well. I think, you know, there's been probably more Commodore 64 games in the last 5 years than I remember coming out since the late 80s. And even, I don't know if you've covered this in your documentary, or you're planning to, that new the C64 OS, which is like a brand new operating system, a commercial operating system for the Commodore 64.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny that you would mention it, because I was just talking about Leif Bloomquist and how we had interviewed him at the Toronto Pet Users Group, because they had an event that was called World of Commodore, and they do that every year in December near Toronto. But another guy who attended that was Greg Nasu, who is the, you know, the creator of C64 OS, and he gave a talk there. And man, it is really impressive what he has been able to get the Commodore to do on such limited resources. And we did have an interview scheduled with him, but due to some unforeseen circumstances, we couldn't get it in. So we are hoping, you know, if we're funded and we go on to develop the entire film, then Greg is definitely on our list to be interviewed, because that's had such a massive impact on the community. And it is such an amazing OS that he's developed and continuing to develop.
Well, let's get into the film then. Because, I mean, you mentioned on your website that the Commodore 64 impacted the course of your life and actually influenced your decision to become a filmmaker. So How did that journey happen for you?
Yeah, so as I was mentioning earlier, I started out with a Bredband C64, and that eventually died, which probably doesn't surprise anyone. And then
from overuse, probably, yeah.
And then I moved on sort of late in the game to a 64C, but that just again goes to show the love that people tended to develop for it. You know, I think it was 90 or 91 when I bought the 64C. And what was funny was at the time my dad had purchased, you know, an IBM PC. I think it was like $3,000 or $3,500 for a dual floppy, you know, IBM PC XT and a printer. And I would, you know, he kind of tasked me with like, okay, I need you to learn how to use this so I can use it. And I was just so like underwhelmed by its capabilities and the fact that it was monochrome. I was like, I just don't understand why anybody would want this when you can have a Commodore 64.
Yeah.
But after high school, I kept my 64C through high school. And then when I went to college, that was right about the time that the video toaster, which, you know, is a video editing hardware that runs on an Amiga, you know, Amiga 2000 and other Amigas, that started just exploding. Everybody was using it. And at my college, they had a studio where they had it installed, and I spent hours and hours in there editing videos and creating graphics. And, you know, it had Lightwave 3D, which, you know, I got really far into using that, and people were just like amazed at what the machine could do, especially for the price, you know. To have equipment that could do that outside of the video toaster was probably, I don't know, you know, $60,000-$80,000, and you know, you could probably get a toaster and you know, an Amiga sub 15,000, I think. So it was a solution for a lot of people. So my first experiences with filmmaking and storytelling through editing was with the video toaster. And after I left college, I then went on to my first job, and they also had a video toaster system as well, and I worked on that for several years. So Commodore has like, it's always been there in my life, I guess. I didn't expect to have such a long history with it, you know, and then it kind of dropped off. You know, I started using PCs and you know, kind of left it on the shelf for many years. But then again, you know, in 2017, you know, I saw your video and it reignited my interest. And I kind of thought to myself at first, well, you know, I'll just get one and you know, use it and it'll be fun. And, you know,
that's how it starts.
That's right. And now I'm looking over my left shoulder here and I probably have 20 or 30 on the shelf and in various states of repair. And, you know, now I have Commodore machines that I didn't have growing up, like a Plus 4. So shout out to the Plus 4 there. And, you know, a PET even, and several Amigas, you know, 1200, a 500. And, you know, part of it is I just want to experience the things that I feel like I missed out on, you know, back in the day. So Commodore has always been there. And I, you know, when I was younger, I used to kind of like, this is a little weird and embarrassing, but I used to do like little music videos. You know, I would play music on my cassette stereo, and then I would like try to program, you know, things in BASIC that would make things happen on screen and time with the music, you know, just for fun. So that was my first, you know, foray into editing and filmmaking, sort of ridiculous, but it goes.
I think the fact that the Commodore machines were, you know, compatible with PAL and NTSC, weren't they? So you could, you know, they were really suited to doing video, weren't they? Even rudimentary video.
Oh yeah. And yeah. That carried on, you know, right into the Amiga days too. I remember someone telling a story about how they were demoing the first version of the video toaster at this news station. And, you know, the engineers there were kind of like turning their noses up at it. And they're like, you know, but then the presenter was telling them like, oh, this is video compliant. It's not like some, you know, this is NTSC signal compliant. And I think that really shocked them and, you know, gave them a little bit more respect for the chops that the system had. So, yeah, having NTSC or PAL compatibility is has been really essential, I think, to the Commodore's success. All the Commodore computers.
Even over here, I mean, they were mainly used for, you know, games machines, admittedly. I think, you know, most kids at my school at one stage had an Amiga 500. But even then, I mean, I was in, like, the video club at school where we'd, you know, we'd do video editing on VHS to VHS machines. And then one day I told my teacher that the Amiga could do video credits, you know, rolling at the end of the film. So I used to bring my Amiga 500 in and then hook it up, you know, and we'd use it for titling, basically. So even at that, you know, early days, it was definitely apparent that the Amiga had a step up over other machines.
Oh, yeah.
You know, at the time for doing that kind of thing, definitely. But I mean, you know, your film, obviously, we've talked a bit about the historical aspect there, but you mentioned there that you really want to focus on the current community of the Commodore 64 as it exists today. So why have you chosen that angle instead of the, you know, the usual more historical perspective?
Well, I think there's been a lot of good YouTube videos and even some documentaries that really cover in depth the history of Commodore and all the personalities, you know, from Jack Tramiel, the president, to other major figures in Commodore. The company, you know, but there's not a ton out there about what's really happening today. And I think that I sort of had a joy and surprise of discovering that, oh my word, there's this huge community. And there's a desire, you know, on my behalf to let others know about that. You know, I feel like I have a couple Commodore t-shirts and wear them occasionally. And I feel like everywhere I go, someone will ask me, they're like, hey, is the Commodore 64, is that like that computer from the 80s? Yep. I grew up
with
that.
You know, it's crazy. I saw a guy wearing a Commodore CDTV at a service station randomly about 4 or 5 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So that is very niche.
Yeah. And once somebody recognizes that, it's like the stories start spilling out of them. Like, oh, I used to go over to my buddy's house. We'd stay up all night playing video games and drinking Mountain Dew, you know, and it was so much fun. Or I used to call this BBS, or, you know, we did this with it. We did that with it. And it's like you start to realize once you, you know, sort of pull the cover back, what a cultural impact the machine had. And I feel, you know, a bit of sadness recognizing that's not the story that history tells. You know, if you ask, I think, the average person on the street today, you know, under 35, you know, if you ask them, what are the computers that really launched the computer revolution, you know, as you understand it, they're going to say Apple. And it's not that Apple didn't have a major hand in it. They did, for sure. But I don't, you know, I would argue that the Commodore 64 and other Commodore machines had no less of an influence, no less of an impact. And I think it could be argued had a much greater impact. But, you know, it's branding, right? And you know, the winners sort of write history. And so I see it in part two that the film is sort of an effort to write that, invite people into the community and sort of, you know, correct history a little bit.
I remember in the 90s watching I don't know if you've ever seen this. I think it was a three-part TV documentary series. I think it was on PBS out in America, and it was on Channel 4 here in the UK, called Triumph of the Nerds.
Mm-hmm.
It was by Robert Cringely.
Yes.
It was around the time that Windows 95 came out. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting down watching that, and it was about the history of home computing. And I thought, well, any moment now, they're going to get to Commodore and the Amiga. It's all going to be in here. Not a single mention of it. It was all IBM, Microsoft, Apple. I remember even back then being a bit deflated, like, hang on a minute, there was a lot more happening out there than what's being covered on TV. So
yes.
I do think it is now. It's very good that we can cover that history, that we've got a platform there.
I think that's 100% true. And yes, I have seen that documentary. And it's so funny to hear you say that, because that was my reaction as well. I'm like, what in the world? Like, no mention of Commodore at all. Like, that does not seem right. And, you know, that is really, really prevalent. Like, and that's a perfect example of sort of the effect that, you know, I was talking about just a little while ago. But yeah, it's interesting because, you know, there's some stories out there, and this is another thing we cover with one of the interviewees in the film, is there's a story that at one point Jobs tried to sell Apple to Chuck Peddle of Commodore. He's like, yeah, we're going to be worth a lot of money. And, you know, so if you give us $2 million right now, we'll sell you Apple. And wow, I mean, the impact that could have had. And you know, I think I remember hearing that, you know, Wozniak was really embarrassed by that because they hadn't even produced a working computer yet. And Chuck Peddle was actually over there helping them with the integration of the processor because they really couldn't figure it out on their own. So it's amazing to think that, you know, if not for the assistance of, you know, Chuck Peddle of Commodore, the Apple II might never have existed. And if Chuck had like taken Steve Jobs seriously, the course that Apple Computer took as a company might have been very, very different. So yeah,
it could be using a Commodore iPhone today instead of an Apple one. Yeah.
That's right. I think there is a Commodore phone out there.
I think there is, actually. Yeah, Commodore Pet when I saw that.
Yeah.
Well, talking about people that you've interviewed for the film, I mean, you mentioned that there's four in-depth interviews you've done so far. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you mentioned Bo Zimmerman there as well. Mm-hmm. So who else have you spoken to for the film so far, and how did you go about choosing them?
Another really well-known personality that was just incredibly gracious to allow us to come and interview him was David Murray. You know, he's a very the 8-bit guy, sorry, as he's more well-known. And he was just super gracious. I really, you know, I sort of emailed him on a lark. I did not expect that he would say yes. If you watch David's channel at all, I think sometimes I'm like, man, when do you sleep? Like, you've got so many things going. You know, he's producing videos, and he's working on the Commander X16 computer, and he's just doing so many things that I thought, there's no way this guy is going to have time for us. But, you know, sort of one line response was like, yeah, you know, I would love to be a part of getting behind an effort like that. And I think that just sums up the community as a whole. It's like, yeah, people are willing to come together for their love for this particular machine. So yeah, we had about 2-hour interview with David and there in his studio, and he, you know, we just talked all things Commodore, and he told sort of his personal inside story of his experience with the 64, and you know, and we went on into you know, the games that he's developed for the 64, and he also he had a Max machine that he showed us and kind of talked about how the Max was really the first 64. So like, yeah, it's just fascinating to hear from different people that are well-known, but maybe well-known YouTubers, but maybe they haven't really told their story about the 64 in particular, and to sort of get that from them. And then Leif Blomquist, I mentioned, and he's part of the Toronto Pet Users Group. And he had some incredible stories to tell himself about his involvement with the 64. And like I said, how it's led him into the aeronautical industry. And then another guy that I felt very honored to get an interview from was Anthony Becker. And he is probably better known as sort of the second half of the Guru Meditation. He and Bill Winters, that's an Amiga channel that they've run for a number of years. But Anthony is actually a huge Commodore collector himself and has some like very unique and rare Commodore hardware, one of the things being a Commodore 65. And, you know, that's another thing that I think if you've been away from the Commodore scene for you know, a number of years, since the 80s, you may not know about the Commodore 65, but that was a prototype that Commodore developed that was sort of supposed to be the successor to the 64 in a lot of ways and much more capable, you know. And Anthony actually, you know, took it out and showed it to us. And some of those prototypes, which I'm not sure, I don't think anybody's sure, but I think maybe there's only 200 or so or even less in existence. You know, they sold for, you know, $30,000, $40,000, even $80,000 or more. So yeah. Just ultra rare stuff that.
And I think Commodore was selling them at their fire sale when they went bankrupt for about $20 back then, I think.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. If I remember right, Anthony related that he bought one again, sort of on a lark. He heard it about it tangentially, and I think he paid like $40, which is just crazy. And so, yeah, I mean, I have been a filmmaker for about 25 years, and, you know, I really love getting those sorts of stories out of people that you're just not otherwise going to hear, and hearing about their history with the machine and why it means so much to them and how it influenced their life.
Well, how did you approach, obviously so far, you know, that this section of the movie that you've made so far before the funding is completed, how are you approaching the storytelling aspect of the film and the narrative around the interviews?
Well, I really think my approach could just be summed up as storytelling, you know, and it's based on, you know, the person's particular intersection with the Commodore community. You know, you take Anthony, for example, he has a huge collection. So, you know, during our time with him, we sat down first and like heard his whole story. How did you get a 64? What path did things take after that? You know, what led you into, you know, your involvement with Amiga stuff? And then, you know, sort of taking a tour of their collection and being able to see some of the ultra rare and just fun things that they have. Anthony in particular has a lot of unusual stuff, early Commodore stuff. He has a Commodore typewriter and some adding machines and, you know, back when Commodore was doing those things, but he also has like some really weird and wonderful, products that were created after the Commodore's, branding rights were sold off to other companies. So he has like an MP3 player that's branded as a Commodore and wow. Some other weird and wacky things that he's acquired over time. And, you know, we sort of took that same approach with Bo, although, you know, touring Bo's collection would probably be, you know, a 12-hour documentary in and of itself. His collection is so huge and it's so well curated, and you can ask him about any machine in that room and he's just intimately familiar with it. And you know, again, we also sat down with Bo and heard his story and like, you know, what kicked this off for you? Why are you just so passionate about these machines? What do they mean to you? And I think, you know, for people that did grow up with the 64, hearing that stuff just again makes them feel a sense of community, a sense of camaraderie, and, you know, like, hey, I wasn't the only one. Because I think, you know, growing up in the 80s, we're all kind of isolated from each other. But you asked earlier what's made things ignite, you know, reignite the community. Well, the internet and the fact that that now there's this, you know, like sort of virtual space to gather and discover that, like, oh, well, this wasn't just sort of a thing where I lived. Like this was a thing in Germany and Poland and Japan and, you know, and in South America and all over the world. And, you know, it's just really shocking to find out how huge the community is.
I mean, if when the crowdfunder finishes, is that kind of a plan to explore a bit more of the global essence of the Commodore 64 community and travel and interview people around the world?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the biggest expense in the production of the film is, of course, well, two things, time and money, right? Every single film out there would like to have more time and they'd like to have more money. And, you know, what we can or can't do will definitely be controlled by the budget. You know, we had to really spend a lot of time analyzing, like, what is realistic to raise, number one, and number two, what's realistic in terms of time, because we don't want it to be, you know, 8 years before this thing comes out. So we tried to scale those things in a way that wasn't going to doom the project to failure at the start. Because I think, you know, it's a mistake a lot of films make is, you know, they have a grandiose idea of what they can do and what they can cover. And then, you know, the budget is way too high and it doesn't get funded. Or, you know, it does get funded and it's a massive project that, you know, that would take years and years to complete when you're talking about a small team of people. So, yeah, I think definitely what we're able to do, while we are focusing on North America and Canada, what we're able to do in the other areas of the world that we might be able to feature will definitely be influenced by the amount of funding that we bring in. And we're going, you know, our intention is to do the most we can with the resources that we have, you know, recognizing that everybody involved has full-time jobs. I have a full-time job and the other three people on the team also have full-time jobs. So, you know, there's a limit to what we can do. And so we want to keep the film within a realistic scope.
Yeah, and I think that's really wise to do as well. It's, you know, you've got an idea of what you want it to be like and yeah, keeping things realistic and making sure that, you know, you're delivering something in a reasonable time frame, I think is very important. And obviously, I mean, you've put this 10-minute teaser up on YouTube that's already had nearly 70,000 views. And I'm looking through the comments. Everyone is just saying how incredible it looks and they're so hyped for it. I mean, have you had a really good reaction to this so far?
Oh, I think the 10-minute preview really shocked me. You know, I was like thinking to myself, if it gets 5,000 views, that'll be like doing in the first month, that'll like be doing great. And, you know, we'll probably, we will go on if we get that much. If we don't, then I'll really have to think about it. And I think in the first day or two, it got 5,000 views. And I was like, wow. And then it just kept accelerating more and more and more. And, you know, I have to credit one of the guys from the Toronto Pet Users Group. He did a lot to just promote that preview around the different user groups. And I think that really did have a huge impact on people getting exposed to it and seeing it. And of course, I was also talking about it and promoting it on some of the major Facebook groups. But yeah, even with all that, you can never know, you know, you can have a feeling that I think people would be interested and excited about this. But until you actually put something out there, you can't know. And I think it was really important in my mind to like produce something small first so people can see that you're serious about it and the quality level of it. And, you know, that this is something that they can feel good about getting behind. And so, yeah, I was really encouraged by the number of views on the 10-minute preview.
Yeah, and I think people will watch that and they'll see the really high production values as well. I mean, it really shows that you've got, you know, decades of experience of making movies. But so this is a crowdfunder that's literally just launched a couple of days ago when this episode comes out. You've got around 26 days left. But obviously, with any of these campaigns, it's either, you know, either it gets backed or it doesn't happen is generally the case. So I would encourage anyone that's watched that teaser and wants to support this. And I think it is really important that people do get behind this because it is a celebration of the community, a celebration of us. So I'd love to see this come to fruition. You've chosen a platform called Seed and Spark for this. So tell us why you chose that and kind of how this kind of works then.
Yeah, we talk about that a little bit on our blog on iAdoreMy64Film.com. You know, initially I was thinking like, okay, we'll use Kickstarter because like, hey, that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room and everybody uses Kickstarter. And it's not to not Kickstarter at all, but I think part of my concern was we would get sort of lost in the ocean of projects that is Kickstarter. And, you know, I began looking around for other crowdfunding sites and there were a lot of things that were appealing about Seed and Spark. I think number one is just their success rate. You know, their 82% of projects are successfully funded. And I think Kickstarter is maybe down around 30%, I think. Don't quote me on that. But
sounds believable.
Yeah. As I looked into Seed and Spark more, they were a lot more about giving you guidance and helping you to understand how to scale your project properly, you know, having realistic funding goals and the things that you need to do to, you know, have a successful campaign rather than, you know, just sort of taking an hour to to fill out a web form and then posting it, which they yeah. will not allow you to do, which I think is great. You have to meet certain criteria with them. They have to review it. And, you know, you have to demonstrate that you have a plan to make this happen. So I really respect that a lot. And they were, you know, honestly, all of their advice and guidance has proven to be true up to this point. So they specifically focus on film projects. They do some other, you know, projects that are related, but mostly most of the projects on there are independent films. So because of that, yeah, we decided that we were going to cast our lot with Seed and Spark.
And the page looks incredible. I mean, it's all really simple to kind of see what you get for your money. And you're asking for $25,000 for the production, which I think is very reasonable. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen a lot of these movies go for a lot more money than that. So I think that's a easily achievable goal. Mm-hmm. And you, of course, like any crowdfunding, you've got some great incentives as well. I mean, can you talk us through a few of the different tiers and what people can get?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we did try to stay away from physical incentives, even though that's a great way to go. It does put quite a dent in the budget sometimes. And yeah, definitely we're trying to keep our budget lean and do things wisely. But yeah, there's a lot of incentives on there. You can get a sort of a digital badge that shows that you supported the campaign at a certain level. At another level, you can get, you'll receive a digital movie poster for the film. And then as you get up into the higher tiers, you can get an associate producer status or be invited to a preview, an online preview of the film, and even be allowed to have some input into some of the drafts. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunities to intersect with the film and be involved. And I think that's just a reflection of, you know, the ethos that the community has. We wanted to bring that into the development of the film.
And I think the name just sums it up perfectly as well. Did it take a while to come up with that? I Adore My 64?
No. the funny thing about that is, as you probably, I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners know, I Adore My 64 was kind of a campaign slogan back in the 80s for the Commodore 64. Yeah. There's a song out there. I won't try to sing it or anything. Don't worry.
that should be a tear on your crowd.
Yeah, there you go. Sing it, yeah. But yeah, so it was definitely a promotional vehicle that they used back then. But how perfect, you know, for the film. And yeah, it didn't take long to come up with it.
Yeah, well, I think it fits perfectly. I mean, what are you kind of hoping that viewers will take away from the documentary after they watch it?
Well, I think the number one thing that I hope people take away is a decision to get involved with it on some level. Mm. Like maybe it's only, you know, well, I'm going to download Vice, you know, a PC emulator of the Commodore to my machine and enjoy some of the games that I used to play when I was younger, and I'm going to introduce my kids to it. You know, that's been a thing for me, is like, you know, introducing, you know, some of my kids to, like, hey, this is what I grew up with, you know, like, put down your tablet for a second and come check this out. And it's been a lot of fun interacting with them, and their curiosity has piqued. You know, I've taught my daughter some basic programming on it, and you know, that's just skills that you can use throughout the rest of your life. And so, yeah, I hope that people's interest is ignited and they reengage with the 64 and the community that exists out there, you know, on whatever level is right for them. You know, there are some people that are like majorly into repair, and they can, you know, they know how to do soldering and all that sort of stuff. And there's other people that are way far into coding and developing hardware and software. And then there's just people who, like, wow, I'd like to have a 64 and just play the games that I had with it before. And, you know, you can still go on eBay today and buy one and bring it home and, like, relive all the joy.
I love that cross-generational thing you mentioned there as well. I mean, I'm looking at the your 10-minute teaser on YouTube. One of the top comments on there is, I'm a Zoomer, but I've got to respect what the Commodore 64 did for gaming and tech, legendary stuff. So I think there is an interest there beyond, you know, those of us who just had it back in the day. And obviously, you know, it's a machine that left an impact on, you know, millions of people and continues to today. So, Jeff, I wish you all the best with this. Obviously, I'm going to link up the Seed and Spark crowdfunder right at the top of our show notes so people can click straight through. I encourage anyone that wants to see a celebration of the Commodore 64 and its legacy to support this project, because it looks just incredible. Watch the teaser over the weekend and back this if you want to see the full thing. Like I said, though, don't leave it right till the last minute, because, you know, these things do go by pretty quickly. You know, having run a Kickstarter myself, mm-hmm. the amount of people that contacted me about a month later going, damn, I missed it. Can I still get involved? Back this while it's on. So I'll link it up right at the top of our show notes. And Jeff, it's incredible to see your work on this so far. And I really hope you can take this further. All the best with it.
Thank you very much. It's truly an honor to be here.